Fokus på forfulgte. Forfulgte kristne. Vi har haft nogle udsendelser her, hvor vi har fulgt, hvordan det går med forfulgte kristne rundt omkring i verden. Der er nemlig 355 millioner, der er forfulgte, og vi hører ikke så meget om det. Der er en organisation, der hedder Open Doors, som har godt 4.200 medarbejdere, som hjælper forfulgte kristne rundt omkring i verden. I forrige podcast hørte vi fra Pakistan, hvordan man forfølger dem, der ikke er muslimer i det land, som er en muslimsk stat. Nu skal vi til Nigeria i Afrika. Og vedkommende, som deltager i dag, deltager anonymt, fordi det kan koste livet netop det sted at udtale sig for meget. Så velkommen til personen, som nu er med os her, som har cirka 22 år, har han været kristen. Og det, han skal fortælle om, er, hvad der egentlig foregår i Nigeria, som også for manges vedkommende er kristne, men hvordan man fra den muslimske side angriber kristne, brænder byer ned, brænder kirker ned, forfølger. Ja, lad os høre omkring det. Welcome to this podcast here. I've just told about what the impact is gonna be here, and some people will say, oh, we don't need to hear that. And other people will say, yes, what is going on there, actually, because we never hear about it. Let us go to Nigeria. Who are you, not as your name, but as a person?
Yes, thank you so much for having me here. It's my privilege to share about the situation of Christians in northern Nigeria, where I've lived for many, many years. And I've served for more than two decades serving these people in Nigeria who are experiencing difficulties, challenges, increasing violence that is really threatening to disrupt and destroy families. So thank you for having me so we can talk about this today.
Where in North Nigeria do you come from?
I come from the northwest part of Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
And this is where I've lived and grown up. I came from a family that is Islam, but became a Christian early. I had the opportunity because my parents became Christians, and I had the opportunity to become a Christian at an early age. I was actually six, unaided. They were not the ones that made me a Christian, but I listened to the message
mm-hmm.
of the gospel about the salvation through Christ and the forgiveness of sins, and I believed in it and accepted it, and I became a Christian very, very early, and I have been following Jesus for this many years.
Many people are talking about that more and more are getting Christians in Africa. Is that right?
Yes, more and more people are coming to know the Lord through various means. One of the key areas, or one of the key means that people have been receiving Jesus, is through dreams.
Mm-hmm.
They have dreams. Jesus appeared to them in the dream, and they struggle with that. They don't accept Jesus immediately. They struggle with that. And they wonder, like the Muslim, most of the Muslim people, they say, oh, they pray to Allah, say, oh, Allah, I am struggling. I am seeing this dream. I think it's Muhammad. I should be seeing in the dream. Why am I seeing this? And then they have the dream over and over. So it's not just once. And then eventually, they start to wonder, is this Jesus talking to me? And is this the way? And there is a period of listening to or having the dream. And then there is the period of struggling with the dream and its meaning. And there's a period of praying and seeking. And then they also start to evaluate, if I become a Christian, what's going to happen to me? So it's a whole process. It's not just one night of dream and then the next morning they are Christians. No, it takes a bit of time, but they go through this. And this experience eventually helps them to accept Jesus as their Lord.
So you say that many people are getting dreams.
Yes.
What kind of dreams could that be?
Well, dreams in the night where they see Jesus appear to them. And most times they talk about Jesus appearing to them in white clothes.
Hmm.
There is a cleric who himself was a Muslim cleric. He knows the Quran. He had already memorized the Quran and he was teaching. And he went to Mecca. And it was in Mecca that he had a vision. His own was, he was wide awake. And he saw Jesus and he says to him, I am the way that you are seeking. And that had an impact on him when he came back. He didn't share that with anybody while he was in Mecca. But when he came back, he continued to struggle with that. But then he had that again. So these dreams are not happening only once. Because many of these Muslims, they deeply believe this faith and the trust that they have in Muhammad. So it's not very easy for them to just have a dream and then suddenly convert. So it's really, like I say, it's a struggle. It's a process. It takes time. Sometimes they talk to people. Sometimes they have to also fast and seek and say, Allah, please help me. I'm having bad dreams. But eventually they come to realize the conviction is real and it stays with them. And then they come to the process of accepting Christ as their Lord and Savior.
Hmm. What does the society of Islamic people, what does they say about this?
Yes, there are various experiences. But the society usually does not accept when people turn from Islam to Christ. It is not acceptable. They expect the parents, the people who have the first responsibility to take action, are the parents of this person that has come to accept Christianity. If the parents don't take action, then the Muslim Ummah or the Muslim community will take action. And that includes the Muslim clerics. And if you cannot take action against your child who has left Islam and become a Christian, we have the responsibility to take action to make sure that we return him back to Islam. And sometimes also they would use medicine people. You know, when I say medicine people, I'm talking about marabous.
Yeah.
They would invite a marabu and he would come and do different things, because they would say, hey, this person has lost his mind. This is why he has left the religion of Allah and is now following Jesus. He has lost his mind and he needs help. So they bring a marabu and he would spend time, 2-3 days, doing enchantments, trying to get this person back to his senses, so to say. But eventually, you know, many of them don't go back. They stay on, and, you know, then what happens, then they lose everything that they have. I remember one young man by the name of Ibrahim who accepted Christ, but his encounter was through comparative study.
Hmm.
He used to listen to radio programs where Christians were preaching. And his parents, he was 15 when he started listening. And his parents said to him, don't listen to this stuff because you are not a Christian, you are a Muslim. Don't listen to Christian preaching. You know, and they even beat him up for doing that. His father beat him up. But he told me that I never stopped. He continued listening. And for some time, he began to take the Bible and the Quran to study. And he spent about 15 years doing this study.
Hmm.
So this is another way.
Yeah.
While some of them have dreams, and through those dreams they come to know Jesus, other people come to know Jesus through comparative study. Which one is the word of God? Is it the Quran or the Bible? And so they take their time. And so Ibrahim did the same. And over a period of 15 years, he finally came to a firm conviction that from the study of comparing the two books, he concluded that Jesus is the way.
Hmm.
And of course, at that point, he accepted Christ. But what happened to him? He was already married. He had 2 children and he had a shop. He was, you know, a trader. So he was selling fabric, you know, for making clothes. But this shop was given to him by his father. So the first thing was, the father took over the shop from him. The father took away his wife and his 2 children. And then they locked him up in a room and they brought a marabu to try and help, you know, get his senses back.
Because
they think he has lost his senses. Try to get the senses back. But all of that didn't make Ibrahim to go back to Islam. Instead, you know, he was even more determined and more resolute that he would follow Christ. And so he was able to run to some Christians within his city, and those people called us and said, please, you know, there's somebody here who needs help. Please, what can you do to help him? So we were able to connect with other pastors in other cities and helped Ibrahim. And today himself has become a pastor and is preaching the gospel and is discipling those who have come to Christ from Islam as well.
Are we talking about some kind of a competition between two religions, or what is the reason why it's not allowed to go from Islam to Christianity?
Well, it's the nature of Islam. Islam does not allow proselytization. They are, on their own part, they want to convert Christians to Islam because they believe Islam is the way. And they also believe that Christianity is not the way, And the way they look at the West, they look at the West as Satan, especially America, is looked at as the great Satan.
Hmm.
And Denmark and Sweden and all these European countries, they are viewed as Christian countries. So they don't want, you know, anything that has to do with these countries, the religion of these countries. They call the Christian religion a white man's religion. But it's a mistake, because we know that the Christian religion is not a white man's religion. Of course, it was the white missionaries who from Europe that brought Christianity to Africa. But then Christianity did not start in Europe. You know, it started in the same place, you know, that Islam started.
Hmm.
And how many years back?
Mm-hmm.
Many, many years
back. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So, but Islam finds it very difficult to coexist with any other religion in the same place, especially if they feel that they are more in number, they control the politics, then they want to do everything else to diminish the other religion, to maximize Islam until Islam covers everywhere. And they have this concept of what they call Darul Islam and Darul Harb. And Darul Harb means territory of war. Darul Islam means territory of peace. What they mean by this is, wherever Islam is ruling entirely, that is Darul Harb, places like Saudi Arabia. But wherever there are other religions, especially Christianity, competing, so to say, for the hearts of people, that place is regarded to as Darul Harb. That means they still have to do jihad in those places in order to get people, people to accept Islam by choice or by force.
Force, yeah, yeah.
So they use, where they can use force, they would use force. And where they can, they make, where they can make you feel so bad that you are not a Muslim, they would use it. They would use political power, they would use state power where possible, they would use money, they would use whatever they can to make you feel less than a human. Then there's a concept called Dhimmi, which is like a second class citizen. So any minority religion that lives within the context of a dominant Islamic society will experience this Dhimmi mentality. And so there's always this, almost in a sense, a contest between the two religions. Yes, I think it's a contest and it's a struggle for the hearts of people. Because Christians want to get people's hearts yielded to the Lordship of Jesus Christ and accept Him as Lord and Savior, who will forgive their sins and give them eternal life and give them peace. Islam also wants to, he wants the hearts of people. So definitely then we find the two religions are in a contest, almost in a sense competition, you know, for the hearts of people.
If we should look it from another way, I read an article in a big newspaper in Denmark the other day. He was a former Islamic imam. Then he was an atheist, and he's a professor. And now he tells the Western world, don't be afraid for Islam, but be afraid of what the Islam is doing, because the only thing they want is to eliminate the democracy. Is that right?
Well, I think from my observation and experience of Islam in Africa, Islam does not really, really believe in democracy in a sense of when it lives in a place with other religions as well. Maybe when you have Islam is the dominant religion, like 99.9%, and they are in full control. Perhaps, yes, there could be some democracy in that sense. But when you have Islam, like maybe it's 80% and there's 20% or 15% other minority groups, especially Christians, it is especially Christians, you would find that there's that, you know, struggle, and they may subscribe to democracy if it works for them. But if it doesn't, then they are willing to do whatever they can to make sure that they maintain control.
He said that be aware of when it happens to get so many Muslims to Western countries and deny the democracy. You'll get more children, you'll get more population of Islamic, and at a time it will take over.
Yes, my understanding and belief is that Muslims want everybody to become a Muslim. That I explained to you previously, They want everywhere that is non-Islamic to become Islamic. They are very passionate. They are very zealous for their religion. And they are willing to do whatever it takes to spread it. And if it involves sending missionaries to the West, they will. You know, if it involves, you know, whatever else will be involved, they are willing to do that. But the issues of democracy, of course, those are issues the West has to manage and has to handle. But as far as we are concerned in our side, is what we are saying is, can we allow a situation where everybody is free to make a choice? Because yes, Christians preach the gospel, Muslims are also pushing Islam, and they want people to accept Islam, but let's maintain the freedom to choose. If you want to follow Islam, go ahead and follow. It's your choice. Of course, that choice comes with a responsibility. But the same thing, if you want to follow Christ, the same thing. You can follow Christ, but that choice also comes with a responsibility. And so what we are saying and what we want to promote is, let people have the freedom to follow, let them have the choice to follow the religion of their choice.
And now back to Nigeria. There is not that freedom to believe in Christ in the same way as in the Western countries, I guess. But what happens actually when the Muslims take over or try to take over? What do they do practically, actually?
We have terrorist groups that actually identify themselves as Islamic groups, who are terrorizing people across most of northern Nigeria, especially the middle belt of Nigeria and some part of the, you know, the far north. And one of the ways that they are doing that is through abductions and kidnappings. And thousands of people are affected by this. Not only abductions and kidnappings on the one hand, but these militant groups, they also, you know, visit villages, terrorize villages. They burn down villages. They kill people. They burn churches down. They burn food reserves. Sometimes they even destroy farms that, you know, corn that is still growing. So they are using terror, you know, to terrorize people, and not only to terrorize people, but to get them to leave their land. And they take over this land. In 2024, in one of the middle belt states, there are more than 100 communities in Plateau State where they have driven the people from their land. One of the worst attacks took place in Bokkos on Christmas Day, where 160 people lost their lives to the attacks. So this is one of the things that is going on in villages, in the rural areas, where a lot of attacks are going on. Many people are displaced, many lives are lost, property is lost, peace is lost, and these people become internally displaced with families, with wives, children, grandparents, and all of that. And thousands of people are going through a very difficult experience from these attacks. But this is only one side of the story. The other side of the story is the kidnappings and the abductions and the demands for ransom, you know, and what effect it has on the families, sociological, you know, spiritual effects, economic. It has a tremendous effect on families, and thousands are reeling from this pain and trouble going on in the middle belt and the northern part of Nigeria at the moment.
You have an example of a family, a father that was a pastor?
Yes, indeed. There was a pastor who, you know, they wanted to abduct. So he traveled for a speaking engagement, and while he was away, one of the nights they came for his family. They actually came for him, not his family. But he was not at home, so they abducted the whole family. His wife and some daughters. He had about three daughters, and they took all of them. And they walked them for like more than 24 hours walking, you know, on barefoot. They would take them into the bush, into the wilderness, walking on barefoot. And at some point, they realized the mother was so weak, she couldn't continue walking. So just they abandoned her there, and they continued with the daughters. And this girl stayed for 54 days in the camp of the terrorist. What did they see? They were raped over and over. They experienced people being killed in their presence. And these were actually teenagers. So they saw things that normally a teenager should not see. They saw people killed, they saw dead bodies, they saw, I mean, all kinds of experience. And sometimes for this particular family, you know, forced into, you must do, practice the Islamic Salah, or you know, Islamic prayers, otherwise you'll be killed. Threats, I mean, very little food, out in the open, you can imagine the elements, the effect of the elements on their bodies. And meanwhile, the father has to find money to pay the ransom, because they keep communicating with the father. And when he got back, he had to sell off everything he owned.
So they offered him to come back if he had money enough?
No, they offered to restore the family back to him, but he has to pay a ransom. So it is this ransom that he had to sell off everything they had, including their beds and their beddings and chairs and everything they had, because the money they were demanding was 20 million. Now, this is money he had never seen in his life. This is money that the daughters know that their father had never seen. He was a poor pastor. How much was he worth? Very little. Yet they were demanding 20 million. So he tried to raise the money. The church tried to get involved to also raise the money. Friends and family. Basically, they were, you know, impoverishing this family by demanding the sum. And they could, but still they couldn't raise the 20 million.
How much is 20 million?
20 million would be about $20,000, let's say.
$20,000, yeah, okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they couldn't raise that money. And he made a lot of effort. He contacted a lot of people, spoke to families, spoke to church members, spoke to other pastors. You know, but it was difficult to raise that money. But they were able to raise about 5 million. And then, you know, the whole ordeal of taking the money there to the kidnappers, and eventually they were willing to release the girls. But they still violated them more before they released them. And the girls came back. Actually, they had, you know, they had been raped over and over. So you just see, sometimes, I mean, for that family, they didn't come back pregnant. But there are those who, young girls or married girls, come back pregnant. And what happens to their family? How do the family look at them? So it poses a really big challenge to the families of what, you know, these people go through.
And where is the government and the police and the official people here?
I've been involved in at least three situations where we had to pay ransom. I can tell you from my experience only that the police said, just don't threaten the kidnappers, just be as nice to them as possible so that you can be sure that they can release your loved one back. Did they give us any help? Unfortunately, no. Did they go with us anywhere? No. This is also part of what makes people wonder, so what are the police doing? Unfortunately, the police did not help us. They only give you guidance on, oh, maybe if you are negotiating. That's even if you go to talk to them. The other issue is that there are too many cases. And basically, my feeling also is that the police are overwhelmed. Because we're talking about 5,000 people a year that face abductions and kidnappings. And then there are also these attacks that I mentioned, you know. So sometimes, to be honest, they are really overwhelmed. And I think they are understaffed. I mean, there's not enough police, and also maybe under-equipped with the right equipment that they need to really deal with this.
But do they never be arrested for illegal things they are doing?
There are people that have been arrested. There are several short videos on social media that you would see where people have been arrested and they will tell their stories. Well, what happens to them, sometimes, unfortunately, we don't know. This is a strange thing. And people listening will be surprised. What are you talking about? Yes, people have been arrested, but then you don't really know what happens to them.
And you live in a democracy, huh?
We live in a democracy.
So they should have the same working spaces in their room for helping people as we have in the northern countries.
There is not as much accountability as there should be.
There is not.
Because there are many people who have also been caught, terrorists who have been caught, and we heard they were transferred to the capital. And from there, you never hear anything about them. And we found that later, some of them were actually released. So part of the challenge and the problem with these abductions and kidnappings is that there are actually people who are complicit. There are government officials who are complicit, who are part of this. And the leader of the country have mentioned it. You know, our one-time president of the nation actually mentioned it, that there are some fifth columnists within his administration, people who are behind this agenda. So this is not an intentional agenda. Some people want to dismiss it as just crime. Yeah, we know there are criminals who abduct people for money, but this is beyond crime. Actually, it's an intentional strategy to break the spirit of the people and to destroy the community and destroy that trust. What builds a community? Trust, confidence, good relationships, respect for each other. But these people, what they are doing is actually destroying the family, because most of the people kidnapped when they come back, they are back into their family. Sometimes they struggle to be accepted back into the family. Yeah. Sometimes they come with a lot of suspicion because of what they have experienced before.
Where is the media here? Do they write about it?
The media does write about it. But the narrative of the media often is they want to interpret it in other ways. It's just like for many years, Western media interpreted what was going on in Nigeria purely as a struggle for scarce resources.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe that's convenient. And maybe that's comfortable. But when you talk to the people, the whole issue, the whole trapping of the incidences and what they experience, it's clear that this is not just about struggle for resources. Why? Because these people who are doing this, if they have the money, they have access to buy land anywhere in Nigeria. They can buy land, they can do business. There is no limitation. Nobody hinders them. Nobody stops them. But if it is just struggle for resources, why do they take people and when they abduct people, they force them into Islam? They say, you become a Muslim or we kill you.
So that is their goal, that's to force them into Islam.
It's one of the goals.
Hmm.
And part of it is also slavery. They turn them into sex slaves, who have to serve, the interest of these people. But it's always connected to, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. When they attack the villages, this is like a war cry. When they come into the villages, they shout, Allahu Akbar, Allahu Akbar. It's clear, And then they go for churches. I mean, this violence has been growing. In the early days when it started, prime target is church and pastor, and then Christian men. Because they believe that if they destroy these ones, then they are left with women who are helpless. They cannot do anything because most of the women rely on their husbands for their life. The husband is the breadwinner, and the pastor is the leader of the church. So if we kill him, then, we have actually confused and scattered the church. So it's really difficult for believers. But the people who live in Nigeria understand this is a growing, it's not just a one-day thing. It's something that has been growing and the violence has been growing.
Hmm.
But we know what the agenda is about. It's about the faith that we have in Christ Jesus. If we became all Muslims, a lot of this would stop.
When we look at the very high price you pay for that as human beings and families that are not going the way that the terrorist wants, what would you see in the future will happen here? I mean, you don't dare to stand ahead and say, listen here, what I have seen, because then you would be slaughtered, actually.
Definitely, they would target anyone that would speak out.
Hmm.
Because part of their strategy, I believe, is they want to continue doing what they are doing without the rest of the world knowing what they are doing. It's part of their success is in hiding their motives and why they are doing what they are doing, and also continuing to do it without much coverage. But we are hoping for the future. We have a new government, and the new government seem to be positively trying to deal with the problem. We have to give it a bit of time to see whether, what their true intentions are. But we get reports of military really going out against the terrorists, and they are also succeeding. But the number of terrorists is also, we have a huge number. I think we're talking between 5,000 to 10,000 terrorists who are out there in different parts of the country. So the military is saying that we get reports on the news, you know, military has done this, military has done that. Yes. So we are hopeful that the present leader may have the political will, which is one of the issues. The political will to address this issue is part of what we need to take charge of this situation and turn it around.
How is your daily life when they know that you are going out, speaking out the truth about this? Do you feel fear?
There's a certain level of risk attached to this, speaking out. These terrorists also attack Muslims sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Why but do they do
but
that?
But there are Muslims that are speaking out, not agreeing with them.
Okay.
And not agreeing with their agenda and what they are trying to do. People who are calling for peace, these people are often attacked. So it's not only Christians that are attacked, but even those that are saying, this is wrong. Anyone that says this is wrong can easily become a target. And so with what I'm doing, there's a possibility of being attacked too. However, my confidence is, well, I'm doing what God asked me to do. And my hope and trust is in God that He will protect me, and whatever He wishes is what will happen. But I'm concerned about the people. Our people are suffering, and someone has to speak out, and it happens to be me.
What is your daily work, actually?
My daily work is, you know, working with these people, especially when attacks happen. We have to go to places where the attack happened and try to find out the people who are affected. We organize relief work, so that people can be supported, people can be helped. We also organize medicals so that people can, those who are wounded can be assisted. So this is on a regular basis. This is what we are, you know, involved in, to try to help the people who are experiencing the situation. And we also have a trauma engagement where we train caregivers to help in the community around the north to help people, because there are different experiences and there are so many people affected by this situation. We need a lot of caregivers. We, at the moment, we have trained up to like 1,000 caregivers who are helping. But we have a trauma center also for really desperate cases where people will come there and we will spend time with them. They have professional psychologists who give debrief, but not only debrief, but also prayer to, you know, help these people to heal, restore hope, so that, you know, life can be bright again and they can have a future again, you know, help them to deal with the trauma, which, you know, many of them are not able to sleep for many, many weeks because of the trauma, and they have health issues related to that. And many of them are not able to relate normally with other people because of the trauma they experience. So the center is really helping them to heal, so they are able to have restored relationships again. They're able to sleep again. Mm. And they can have a hope for life and say, okay, now I can pursue something. So this is part of what we are doing to help these communities that are affected in many of these areas.
Now, you told the story about the children of the pastor that was taken out in the bush and saw other people who were killed, and they were even teenagers, those kids here. When I read something here about what happened down there, is it about 9,000 schools that were closed?
Yes.
For me, it sounds totally unreasonable. What's happening here? We're talking about teenage children and under that are faced with things that they shall live with the rest of their lives.
Yeah, and things that they should never have seen or never have experienced. Yeah. We talk about thousands of schools, like you mentioned, that have been closed down because, you know, the areas have become completely unsafe for the children.
Hmm.
I mean, just recently, not long ago, there was how many children were abducted in a whole school. A whole school was abducted. And this is 200 plus children taken away into the bush, you know, into the wilderness, taken away. I mean, small children, minus, absolutely minus, taken away for days. But thank God there was, for this particular case that happened just recently, you know, there was negotiation and, you know, they were able to get some of them back. But there have been abductions where they take the whole school. I remember one school close to Kaduna that they took the entire student body. These were teenagers. And they were there in the camp for months. And negotiations were made. And each parent had to pay millions to get their child back. You cannot even begin to conceive what this is like. The kind of fear, pain, despair, hopelessness. People asking questions. When is this going to stop? And who is going to come to our aid in this situation so that these things can change and we can have a life again? Because in many of these places, people no longer have, you know, a life.
And what will the impact of those children's life be in 20 years from now, having this in their mind?
Yeah, this is why we are working on, you know, we're not only helping women and men, but we also have children trauma care programs to help them. Because, you know, what would happen to a child with this kind of thought in his mind? And it literally can turn him into, you know, some children will become monsters because they become angry at what happened to them in their growing up years. And who do they blame? They would blame someone, you know. When something happens, people are always trying to make sense of it and they ask the question, why? You know, and sometimes they think, oh, I was bad, so this is why this happened to me. Or maybe my parents were not careful enough. Or maybe my school was this. They will have somebody to blame. And some of the children will turn out and become very violent because of the experiences that they have had. Things that they have seen that they should never have seen.
And maybe end up in a group like that?
Yes, this is also a possibility. Because there's also the anger of revenge that many struggle with. I remember a young man whose father was killed by Boko Haram. They just streamed into their town, you know, opened fire, and they started to look for people. And he was, you know, the father actually ran to his family house because some of his siblings, the father's siblings, were Muslims. So he thought, if I run back there, I will be safe. But the terrorists went right to that house. They ask everybody to come out, and he was also had to, you know, they forced him to come out, and they ask, are you Muslim? They said yes. Are you Muslim? They said yes. And they ask him, are you a Muslim? He said, no, I'm a Christian. And they took him out of the compound and they shot him there. You know, so his son was very, very angry with what happened, and he vowed that one day he would find these people who did this and he would like to take revenge. So this is one of the responses that young people can grow up with, because you snatch their childhood away, you snatch their innocence away. What does it do? Part of what it can do is that they get angry and, you know, they want to revenge. They look for opportunity one day, but, you know, it has to be the work of the Lord in their hearts and their minds to come to the point where they say, well, yeah, they did that to me, but I am willing to forgive them. And this is part of what we see in the trauma center that we have built. People come there, they receive help, and people who are so angry, who are, you know, just, they said they must, in their heart, they say, I must revenge what's happened. You know, they get touched and they come back and say, okay, I forgive them. It's a miracle of God.
When, if you should make a speech to the Danish people, you did it to the Britain people the other day here. If you should make a speech to our politicians in Denmark and our society, what would you say, actually? What would you ask for help from us to help you out of this situation?
Yeah, we will ask you to intervene where you can, especially with the, you know, with governing bodies, maybe with EU, groups that have influence that can influence and maybe influence a change in the country, and help to disarm the Fulanis who are roaming all over the place with weapons and killing people. I mean, the Fulani terrorists. If we can disarm them, that would be very helpful. Can the Danish government help us with that? I don't know. But we ask. We need help, because the sheer numbers of people that are affected by what is going on is big. Talk about 5,000 people experiencing abductions and kidnappings, talk about an equal number of people that have been killed every year in Nigeria for the last 5 years. It's a huge problem. Talk about internally displaced people. We're trying to do our bit to, you know, rehabilitate, provide relief, help people, you know, to go back to their, to go back to live somewhere else and have a source of living. So we need help with money. We need help with restoring people back. We need help with our trauma program. But whatever the Danish government can do to influence maybe the EU to take action, perhaps that could help the situation.
So would you ask, what we're talking about, maybe 1 million of people?
Are you talking about the number of people affected?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, it's over the years, it's actually, we're talking about more than 5 million.
5 million people
affected.
It's just about
across the whole nation.
Yeah.
Take note that Nigeria is 200 million people.
200 million people.
This is the population. And a significant part of these people have been affected in the northeast, north central, and the northwest with these problems.
So we're talking about other wars around in the world that are focused on. But this is even worse in Africa, actually.
Yes.
If you're looking at the human cost.
There are close to 2 million in Burkina Faso alone as well. People who have been displaced have left their homes, their farmlands, their churches, their businesses, and they have to move south in order to be safe. So it's a big crisis in West Africa, and we need help.
So what you actually are doing is asking both the politicians in Denmark and the medias maybe to focus on what actually is going on.
Yes, indeed.
And
the more people know about this, the
and
better.
Pass it on to EU, for example, so that it could be a European goal to come and help.
Indeed, we want the media to focus on this issue. Let people know more about it, of what is happening, because part of the issue with this situation is that very little is known. The media is not reporting as much as it should. Sometimes I think some of them are discouraged because maybe they have reported a bit, but you know, no action has come. But perhaps the more people know about it, the better. And the more Christians know about it, because Christians will pray. We believe in the power of prayer, that God answers prayer. And people pray passionately, there will be a solution. We have a project though, we call it Arise Africa. Is a campaign for 4 years trying to draw attention of people to what is happening in West Africa. And we want to engage as many people as possible to pray and also be concerned and then get involved, however you can get involved, so that we can help people who are suffering, but also we need governments to get involved so that we can mitigate this crisis and stop this aggression against ordinary citizens who are Christians, but not only Christians, anyone affected. We want them to be free. We want them to live in a free country and be able to lead, go about their life freely, go about their goals, what they want to achieve. The same kind of freedom that we see here. We wish that you can help us to accomplish that kind of freedom. But also, there's another angle to it. If the situation doesn't get better, what's going to happen to the population? Imagine if Europe is already struggling with a lot of people, immigration, you know, illegal immigration through the oceans, you know, into Europe. Imagine if we have a big problem, bigger problem in Nigeria, and people start to move, you know, where they're going to. They are going to have even more crisis in Europe because people are going to try to find safer places to go to. And so it's for the good of not only Nigeria, but it's for the good of Europe as a whole that this issue is fixed, because Nigerians can actually live in Nigeria and live peacefully. And they have enough resources to take care of themselves in Nigeria. But with this situation, it's really aggravating new tensions in the country. And people are talking, the north Southeast are talking about having their own country. The Southwest is also talking about their own republic. So there are threats to this. This insecurity is making people feel like, look, let's just split this country. There are people who still believe that Nigeria should remain one. But, you know, what's going to happen if it splits? Do we want that? Most of us, or many of us, believe that Nigeria is better together. But some people are pushing because of the, purely because of the insecurity that is happening. But other factors as well. So we are calling, we are calling on you in Denmark, calling on the politicians to lay emphasis on, to focus on this, and to also to draw the attention of EU to this issue. We don't only want money, really. We thank God for whatever funding we can get to support the people, but much more we want action that helps to stop this. And we think that Europe has the power to help.
And actually, if they not are coming to help, then they will have a problem money-wise in years from now, as you said.
Yes, they will have a immigration problem, humanitarian problem already, and other attendant problems that they would
have. So it's help for you and self-help, actually.
Yes, indeed.
To have a balance in the world.
Indeed.
And you're free to come here and say that, but you can't say that in your own country.
Very difficult. Very difficult to say it in my country. They will come after me.
I wish you a good work. I wish you peace in your heart for this. And I wish that the Danish government and listeners would open their eyes. Your organization has open eyes, open doors, and actually go and help you so we can help each other in the whole world. Is that the message?
Indeed. We need to hold hands together. We are going through this now. Hold our hands so that we can come out of it. So that if others are going through something else, we can all join hands and help them. So that let peace reign in the world and let people have the freedom to follow their convictions.
Thank you for taking the time and telling us this fantastic message. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me, and I pray that God bless your work that you're doing. Thank you.
Same to you, definitely. Thank you.